This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Lori Richards.
And Irene Friedman.
And we will be bringing you world and national news from USA Today. And Irene will start us off.
Okay, at the top of the page, election 2024 Super Tuesday. There's not too much here. We see two people, lady has her dog with, and they are at a voting booth. And it says, key day at the polls in non-traditional year. Voters in 15 states and American Samoa cast their ballots on Super Tuesday, traditionally a pivotal day forecasting how presidential primaries will play out. But with a showdown between Democratic President Joe Biden and Republican Donald Trump almost assured, races including congressional bouts in the North Carolina gubernatorial primary also drew a lot of attention. And then they say to find election results, coverage, and analysis, go to usatoday.com. And also, we know you like talking politics. Now you can text with us to get news about the 2024 election. Send straight to your phone. Send a text to 301-888-6791 to get started. Again, 301-888-6791 to get started, and that's with USA Today. And now I'll go on to another article on the front page. Mental health hit hard in pandemic. Use of psychiatric drugs up far more than others by Cecilia Garzella of USA Today. The COVID-19 pandemic was a breaking point for 43-year-old Tamalyn Paredes, an addiction counselor at a methadone clinic in Portland, Oregon. Living in California at the time, she worked at a group home for children with serious emotional disturbances, a job she described as taxing, especially when kids would lash out. Helping those with mental health conditions hit close to home for Paredes. She lived with depression and suicidal thoughts for years, but the hormonal side effects of ovary removal surgery in 2019 made things worse. I felt like my life was falling apart, she said. After moving to Oregon for a new job in October 2021, she decided to prioritize her mental health and see a doctor for treatment. She was diagnosed with ADHD and prescribed medications, which she said have been life-changing. Today, Paredes takes three medications to manage her mental health. Her sleep quality has improved. She has more control over her emotions. Focusing her attention at work has become easier, especially after being fired for performance issues in previous jobs. I cannot go back to not being medicated, she said. A USA Today analysis of Medicaid data for the 60 most used psychiatric drugs showed a growing number of people sought mental health treatment and medication during the pandemic as it pushed people into isolation and dismantled support systems. The analysis also revealed a lingering effect of the pandemic. Mental health-related prescriptions rose further in 2022, up 12% from 2019, outpacing the less than 1% growth in overall prescriptions. That includes prescriptions for generic Zoloft, the most common antidepressant medication, which rose 17% over the same period. More than half of these drugs saw an increase in prescriptions since 2019, and the steepest increase was among ADHD drugs, Concerta and generic Adderall. Even before the pandemic, the use of mental health drugs was on the rise due to more affordable medication options and broadening acceptance of mental health treatment. That increase accelerated as the pandemic deepened the country's mental health crisis following widespread loss and adversity. The upending of normal structures because of COVID-19, alongside the heightened awareness of mental health and the expansion of conditions being diagnosed, are likely contributing to the rise in mental health prescription drugs. Amy Wuremeyer, president of the American Association of Psychiatric Pharmacists, told USA Today, according to the Census Bureau's January 2024 survey, the percentage of people experiencing anxiety or depression remains double that of pre-pandemic levels. Across all ages, over a fifth of adults and more than a third of those under 30 reported feeling anxious or depressed. Among transgender and bisexual people, the problem is worse. 50% of transgender people and 44% of bisexuals said they experience anxiety or depression. This is just coming to a point where for many people it's been unmanageable, said Dr. Doss, chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Addiction Council. One silver lining of the pandemic, Doss said, we all started to talk about mental health more and bring it to the forefront. The growing toll that the mental health crisis is exacting on the country is born out of other data. For example, lives lost to suicide and drug overdoses are at record levels. Policymakers and government officials have taken note and recommended actions to fortify mental health programs and reinforce social support systems, such as creating mobile crisis teams, establishing a national suicide prevention hotline, and implementing paid family leave laws. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy last year issued an advisory underscoring the urgency to address the public health crisis of loneliness, isolation, and lack of connection. There's increasing recognition that we shouldn't be thinking about mental health conditions any differently than we think about physical health conditions, Wehrmeyer said. But for some reason in the past, she said, we have blamed people for having to take depression medication or substance use disorder medication. Financial barriers such as limited insurance coverage for mental health treatment or high costs for uninsured patients also make it difficult for some people to access medications, Wehrmeyer said. Expansive market for mental health drugs. Mental health drug use has grown over the past two decades, partly due to the introduction of lower-cost generics, according to Arthur Wong, a managing director focused on healthcare at rating agency S&P Global Ratings. It has become a high-demand area, Wong said, with drug makers developing new alternatives and researching novel approaches to treat depression and anxiety. Among the generics that became available this century, Zoloft's generic version, sertraline, is the most widely used drug for mental health, according to USA Today's analysis of federal drug use data. The lower-cost alternative was released 15 years after its brand name hit the market in 1991. As of early February, generic Zoloft is 300 times cheaper than the brand name, based on average prices pharmacies pay per pill. That means a month's supply of Zoloft can cost patients without insurance upwards of $400, while the average retail price for the generic alternatives hovers around $20, according to GoodRx. In the past 5 years, prices of the 30 most prescribed generic psychiatric drugs dropped faster than the average decrease across all generic drugs, based on USA Today's analysis of national average drug acquisition cost data. That contains information about the amount retail community pharmacies pay for drugs. While generic prices trend downward, brand name prices have steadily risen, a phenomenon dubbed the generic paradox. It is not uncommon for brand manufacturers to raise prices after lower-cost generic equivalents became available, said Andrew Mulcahy, a senior health economist at RAND, a nonprofit research organization. Less than 10% of prescriptions are for brand name medications, but drug companies still turn a profit by selling to a small slice of patients, Mulcahy said. While some patients prefer to take brand name drugs because they believe generic alternatives are inferior or less effective despite meeting the same Food and Drug Administration standards, others stay on costlier medications because no other drug works effectively for them. Lack of funding and a shallow labor pool. The pandemic spurred telehealth expansion, but also aggravated challenges such as burnout among behavioral health workers, high turnover rates, and nationwide staffing shortages. This in turn jeopardizes the quality of care, especially for underserved communities. The vicarious trauma can be high because we hear some horrible stories, said Tamalyn Paredes, who counsels people with opioid use disorder. Paredes treats 140 patients, triple the number she's supposed to, simply because there are more people in need than there are providers. Rural, remote areas are hit especially hard. On many tribal lands, for instance, mental health care doesn't exist at all, said Lori Jump, CEO of Strong Hearts Native Helpline, a nonprofit organization that works with indigenous communities. Most nonprofit centers that operate under government authority rely on grants to provide for patients who can't afford to pay. Some received a temporary reprieve through 2021 American Rescue Plan, which distributed over $3 billion for mental health and substance use grant programs across the country. Central Plains Center in Plainville, Texas, was one of 40 community behavioral health clinics to get a federal grant. It received over $1 million. Despite that, CEO Sherry Bohr said she worries about future funding and what will happen once the grant runs out this August. The facility, Bohr said, serves under 4,000 people a year, most of whom are low-income, uninsured, or enrolled in Medicaid. Another concern weighing on her is the shortage of licensed therapists eager to work in rural areas, Bohr said. This isn't the kind of job you get if you just want a paycheck, she said. Case in point, a job opening for a therapist at Central Plains Center has remained unfulfilled for 3 years. They don't keep the roots here, said Jason Johnson, its associate CEO. They tend to see our small town as a stepping stone. Full impact hard to measure. Many are reluctant to seek help. The uptick in people seeking treatment and medication does not provide a full accounting of the impact of the pandemic on mental health because many are reluctant to seek help, particularly people of color, LGBTQ+ communities, and people with disabilities. It takes time to overcome that hesitation, said Das, a Stanford University professor, adding that among some communities, it gets labeled a personal failing. A 2022 national drug use survey showed that among adults with serious mental illness who didn't receive treatment, a majority reported that they should have been able to handle their mental health on their own. Tanisha Malcolm, who is Black and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder 20 years ago, said her family didn't believe in mental illness or therapy. To them, mental health conditions were not even considered something real, Malcolm said. No one believed that this was happening to me because it doesn't happen to us. The New York City resident said the underlying message was, you have to be strong, be tough. You don't have time to be depressed. Malcolm, who lives alone, also felt anxious and unsupported during the pandemic, she said. Watching COVID-19 cases and deaths rise higher and higher worsened her mental health, so she kept the TV off altogether. As someone with comorbidities, Malcolm said leaving the house was nerve-wracking. She lost friendships and didn't have a community. To remedy this, she co-founded the Black Minds Matter support group in May 2020 at the National Alliance on Mental Illness of New York City to support Black people like herself who live with mental health conditions. Today, the support group is thriving, Malcolm said, adding that participants share wisdom about how to navigate every aspect of their daily lives, being Black and managing mental health conditions. They feel seen, empowered, and cared for. It's just a big group hug, she said. Tamalyn Paredes, who helps people with addictions on the opposite coast in Oregon, said she finds fulfillment in her demanding job by connecting patients with the resources they need. Her goal is to become a licensed clinical social worker, drawing from her experiences at the methadone clinic and children's group home in California. I found that from working with the kids, it gave me street cred, Paredes said. People always say it gets better. It gets better. But I'm proof that it does. Lori?
U.S. woman to become first to sail solo nonstop around the world by Claire Thornton, USA Today. In a sea of male competitors, Cole Brower is the only woman in an around-the-world solo sailing competition that's quickly coming to a close. Later this week, the 29-year-old from Long Island, New York, is expected to cross the finish line in waters off the coast of Spain. At that point, she'll become the first American woman to sail solo nonstop around the world. Friends, peers, and sailing enthusiasts have been cheering Brower on since last October when she embarked on her more than four-month journey. Her boat, First Light, a special model of a racing sailboat called a Class 40, is expected to return to the race's starting point of A Corona, Spain, on Thursday, according to organizers of the Global Solo Challenge. Brower said she anticipates arriving in Spain late Wednesday night or early Thursday. For the next 2 days or so, it's completely moving target, Brower said in a video posted to her Instagram on Monday. The latest official race update on Brower said she was off the west coast of the Azores on Saturday. Long anticipated Cole Brower has been able to avoid the light winds of the Azores high and slingshot east, race organizer Marco Nannini wrote online. She's now sailing on course at constant speeds above 10 knots average. Nannini told USA Today he wanted to organize the Global Solo Challenge to create a platform for sailors like Cole to showcase her skills and move on to a pro sailor career. Over the past several months, Brower has been keeping her more than 400,000 Instagram followers updated and entertained with videos from onboard First Light. The trip has been extremely challenging and physically exhausting, Brower said in one video from December. I don't want you guys to think I'm like Superwoman or something, Brower said. Right now, I've been feeling just broken, she added, describing how she had to fix the boat's autopilot system after injuring her torso against the side of the boat's hull amid intense waves. Who is Cole Brower? Brower is from Long Island and competed for the University of Hawaii sailing team. She went to high school in East Hampton, New York, her university team website says. She is the youngest of more than a dozen sailors or skippers in the Global Solo Challenge. The professional sailor lives in Booth Bay, Maine, and during the spring and summer, she can also be found in Newport, Rhode Island, gearing up for races, the Newport Daily News reported last year. Brower has sailed on First Light, a 40-foot yacht, for over 5 years, the outlet reported. I always said I wanted to race around the world in this boat, she told the newspaper. From above and below First Light's deck, Brower has been sharing aspects of her journey with followers and diehard sailing fans. On New Year's Eve, she donned a dress and danced at midnight, and in another post, she showed off how many pull-ups she can do. As the only woman racing solo, nonstop around the world in the first Global Solo Challenge, Brower said she's determined to prove there's nothing women and girls cannot accomplish. I push so much harder when someone's like, no, you can't do that, Brower told NBC Nightly News. And I'm like, okay, watch me. On her profile page on the Global Solo Challenge website, Brower says she wants to send a message to the sailing community that it's time to leave its male-dominated culture in the past. In the profile, Brower takes aim at a lack of equal pay and what she describes as harassment in the sailing industry. Just as well, this community has built me up. It has broken me and my fellow female teammates down. I am doing this race for them, Brower said. Brower and her spokesperson did not immediately respond for requests for comment. How long has Brower been at sea? Brower has been sailing for over 4 months, departing on October 29th. She is expected to finish in second place in the race behind a sailor who departed about a month before she did. The start times differed because that first place boat, Philippe Delamar's Mowgli, is much slower, Nannini said, explaining the race's staggered start times. The format means that if you enter on a slow, small boat, you can still win, which makes it much more inclusive than an event where a bigger budget is a definite advantage, he said. Francis Delamar will win first prize money of 7,500 euros, about $8,140, and the second and third place finishers will win 5,000 euros, about $5,430, and 2,500 euros, about $2,710, respectively, Nannini said. How dangerous is the sailing race? A medical team, including a nurse and physician, trained Brower and sent her on her journey with medicines and medical supplies in case of any health issues, according to her Instagram account. Early in the race, Brower administered her own IV with a saline solution after she became dehydrated, according to one video posted to her social media. Brower's most serious health scare happened in early December when she said gnarly ocean conditions caused the boat to jolt, throwing her across the inside of the boat and slamming her hard against a wall. Her ribs were badly bruised as a result. Her medical team told her to alternate between taking Advil and Tylenol, Brower said on Instagram. Rigging up a sleeping seatbelt has been added to my priority list, she said in the post caption. I know I'm very lucky that this wasn't a lot worse. What is the Global Solo Challenge? The inaugural Global Solo Challenge is a non-stop sailing race in which competitors departed last year from A Coruña, Spain. The race encompasses nearly 30,000 miles and takes place mostly in the southern hemisphere. After leaving waters off the coast of Spain, sailors travel south around Africa's Cape of Good Hope. Then the race includes the other two capes that together make up the famous Three Great Capes, Australia's Cape Leeuwin and South America's Cape Horn. About half of the other competitors dropped out of the race, according to racing data posted online by the Global Solo Challenge. Delamar finished the race late last month after embarking on his journey in late September, according to race data. Irene?
Okay, finishing up the front page, technology helps allow caregiving from afar. Sheer distance takes toll on millions of families, by Mark Ramirez of USA Today. Alyssa Weekly, a neuropsychologist at the University of California, Davis, trained in developing technology for cognitively impaired older adults, is acutely aware of the challenges of long-distance caregiving. Still, when her proudly independent grandmother began showing signs of what would ultimately be diagnosed as early-stage Alzheimer's disease in 2018, it took her and her family by surprise. Her grandmother, in her 70s, lived alone in Southern California. Weekly and her family were scattered throughout Northern California and Washington. There were a whole host of things that made independent living challenging for her, Weekly said, but there was nobody really there to provide her with care. Soon she and her family found themselves in a position shared by nearly 6 million other Americans, being caregivers from a complicated and often distressing distance. According to an AARP report in 2020, long-distance caregivers represent more than 1 in 10 of the country's estimated 53 million family caregivers, meaning they live an hour or more from their care recipient. On average, they live about 450 miles away. Long-distance caregivers have not been adequately recognized as legitimate sources of care because of the physical distance that makes their contributions less apparent or visible, said Francesca Falzerano, an assistant professor of gerontology at the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. However, we will and will continue to see an increase in individuals who find themselves providing, coordinating, and managing care from afar. Besides presenting logistical and financial challenges, long-distance caregiving can be emotionally taxing, as family members worry about not being there to care for recipients in times of need. Nearly half, 47%, of long-distance caregivers report emotional distress, compared with 28% of those who live less than an hour away, according to a report compiled by the AARP and National Alliance for Caregiving. Caring for a loved one long distance can be utterly overwhelming, said Nancy Liamond, AARP's executive vice president and chief advocacy and engagement officer. According to the results of an AARP survey of women 50 and older released last week, 87% of respondents support making paid family leave benefits available to family caregivers, including 55% who strongly agree with that view. Emotionally draining. From hundreds of miles away, Weekly and her family members took turns managing a growing list of challenges for her grandmother, who would forget doctor's appointments and social engagements. She had trouble picking out clothes or remembering to turn down the thermostat in hot weather. They took steps to provide her with a safe environment, equipping her stovetop with an automatic turn-off function, recruiting neighbors to check in. The concerns, she said, were definitely emotionally draining. weekly worried constantly, feeling guilt and longing to be there even though it wasn't really feasible. She was just starting her career and her mother and aunt were still working too. Moreover, her grandmother wasn't ready to relinquish her autonomy. The struggle prompted Weekly, through her work at UC Davis's medical campus in Sacramento, to develop technology that could help long-distance loved ones better manage caregiving from afar. The technology is still in the early stages. Communication not only with your loved one, but with other family members can be a challenge, she said. It's just the reality that you're all trying to help this person you all love and who you want to have this fulfilling life that they wanted to have in their retirement. Crisis can come quickly. Several factors contribute to producing long-distance caregivers, including a greater number of older adults living longer with chronic illnesses or disability, and more people called on to care for ailing family members from farther away as a result of increasing social and job mobility. As of now, the United States doesn't have an acceptable alternative to family care, so many are unexpectedly finding themselves in this role with little choice, let alone support from healthcare system. From the healthcare system, Falzerano said. While geographically removed from the direct care environment, Falzerano said long-distance caregivers find themselves responsible for a wide range of activities, including financial management, care coordination, and providing emotional support. Renee Perry, Chief Operating Officer for the Senior Source and Older Adult Advocacy Agency serving Greater Dallas, recalled stepping into such a role when her father, who lived nearly 300 miles away in Arkansas, was diagnosed with esophageal cancer in 2022. He died just over a year ago. Sometimes it comes on really suddenly, Perry said. You find yourself in a situation where even with expertise and knowledge, you have to step into a crisis situation where emotions are high and your loved one's life is changing completely. From a distance, Perry said, she tried to make sure her parents' lawn was mowed and the bills were paid. But when her father's condition grew dire, she found herself researching hospice agencies and doing over-the-phone screenings from afar. I was fortunate because my husband was incredibly supportive and managed a lot of her household, she said. He made sure I had an evening to myself or a nice dinner out. Having those people around you who recognize what you're going through and are there for you makes a huge difference. Technology to the rescue. Recent and emerging technologies such as wearable monitors and automated home assistants are helping caregivers better manage. Telehealth opportunities, which were popularized during the pandemic, have been a game changer, Falzerano said. And electronic health portals have allowed families to access information about their loved one's condition. Such technology, Falzerano said, have not only allowed long-distance caregivers to better manage care and virtually engage with care recipients, but they have also opened doors to connect with support groups and others in similar situations. Zoom calls help Perry and her sister, who lives in Chicago, virtually attend doctor appointments with her parents to participate in their care. When you're not there, technology allows you, in essence, to be in the room and hear what the doctors are saying and help your loved ones through that situation, she said. Simplest things can be huge. More than a year after her father died, Perry still makes time to visit her mother to make sure she has the support she needs as she learns to live on her own, getting her comfortable with video call technology so she can see her grandkids. Even online bill paying and being able to order groceries from afar and have them delivered is huge, Perry said. At UC Davis, Weekly's budding technology is an interactive platform, something like a virtual whiteboard that will allow caregiver and care recipient to keep track of activities and schedules. Both have different interfaces, but they sync so that a caregiver can put information into a person's calendar or a to-do list, and it shows on the receiver's side, she said. The technology called Interactive Care, or iCare, is being tested in randomized controlled trials, she said. Though its aim is to help caregivers better operate remotely and to reduce crisis-driven care, Weekly said, it should also help care recipients maintain independence and enhance self-efficacy. The technology can be adjusted if cognitive decline increases. Her grandmother has since moved to Northern California, where Weekly can better help manage care. But it's the long-distance caregiving experience that helped drive iCare. With long-distance caregiving, you're not seeing changes in daily patterns that caregivers who live there may notice, like them going to the bathroom more frequently or missing their meds or waking up later than normal, she said. With long-distance caregiving continuing to fall to millions of people nationwide as the population ages and stays geographically mobile, it's incredibly important to design technology that can meet the changing demography and the needs of our society. Tips for long-distance caregivers. Advocates suggest several tips for family caregivers to help ease the load. Maintain and grow networks of helpers, including friends, neighbors, and faith community members. Create an updated spreadsheet with contact information and the roles those people can play in a crisis. Use that network to identify contractors and handymen who can assist with plumbing, lawn services, and the like for the care recipient. Familiarize yourself with aging advocates in the care recipient's community. Use services such as Elder Care Locator to identify resources such as Meals on Wheels, respite care, and minor home repairs or modification. Geriatric care managers can also be hired to coordinate care and appointments in some communities. Look to home and community-based services, and in parentheses, it has capital HCBS, for resources, peer support, education, and training. Ensure that you can access any necessary financial, legal, and insurance details, and that you clearly understand your loved one's wants and needs. Take steps to ward off frauds and scams from those who prey on the elderly, particularly those with cognitive decline. Check financial statements regularly and get to know who else is communicating with your loved one. Use available technologies to manage things like banking online, ordering groceries, setting medication reminders, and getting prescriptions refilled. Fall detection devices and video doorbells can help provide peace of mind, and video chat technologies not only help caregivers keep in touch, but also participate in medical appointments and other crucial encounters. Don't forget to care for yourself. Remember that long-distance caregivers can play supporting roles for family members who do live close to or even with an ailing parent, giving them respite from their daily responsibilities. Lori?
Moving on to page 2, one dead, one injured in explosions, blaze. Biggest fire engulfs building near Detroit. By Alyssa Robinson, Christina Hall, Emily DeLetter, and Sibel Mays Osterman of USA Today Network. A 19-year-old died after he was hit with a flying object from a fiery explosion at a vape distributor about a quarter mile away in a Detroit suburb. Fire officials raced to put out a massive fire as hundreds of explosions boomed in Clinton Township, about 25 miles north of downtown Detroit, about 9 p.m. on Monday. The explosions and fire happened at a business building that housed Select Distributors, as reported by the Detroit Free Press, part of the USA Today network. Fire Chief Tim Duncan said the 19-year-old may have been observing the fire from a nearby car wash when he was struck, but officials were still in the process of investigating the death. Police said area residents and businesses were evacuated. Duncan said he could hear the explosions from his house 7 or 8 miles away as he rushed to the scene. You could see the amount of fire just coursing in the sky, he said at a news conference on Tuesday morning. The explosions were actually shaking the car. Duncan said the explosions were so intense that firefighters couldn't initially approach the building. We had to back out, he said. There was no way we could put people in harm's way like that. This was by far the biggest one that I've ever seen, said Duncan, who has fought fires for 25 years. The fire was reportedly under control by 11 p.m. Monday, but the cleanup for the explosions and fire continued through Tuesday morning. Here's what to know about the fire. Where were the explosions? The fire and explosions began in a building that housed Select Distributors, police said. Duncan said Select Distributors provides gases for vape pens. The building also houses Goo, a vaping distributor that had over 100,000 vape pens in the storage at the time of the fire. They literally received a truckload of butane within the past week, and they still had over half of that left, said Duncan said. So this is what you're seeing strewn throughout the area. Duncan said employees were interviewed by officials from the local fire department and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives on Monday night. The investigation is ongoing under the jurisdiction of both agencies, Duncan added. Clinton Township Police are also assisting. Our last inspection did not show this amount of material in that building, so we're going to look into that, he said. Residents up to 10 miles away in Macomb Township reported hearing loud bangs that persisted for more than an hour. Smoke and flames could be seen for miles. Were there any injuries? Duncan said a firefighter was briefly hospitalized after he was hit with broken glass and shrapnel from the explosion. Clinton Township Supervisor Bob Cannon said the firefighter was injured when an object went through the windshield of the fire truck. Both a police and fire vehicle were also hit and damaged by exploding projectile canisters. Duncan said county officials had to scrape the road to clear debris from the explosions. Did the fire affect the air quality? Duncan said a hazmat team that arrived to test the air quality on Monday evening concluded that the area was safe. They monitored the situation. They had all their equipment set up, Duncan said. Everything came back fine. Macomb County Executive Mark Hackle said on Monday night that the preliminary findings from air quality tests determined there was smoke, but nothing hazardous. Testing was mostly west of Grosbeck, as the wind was pushing smoke westerly and semi-northerly, he said. Hackle said people with smoke allergies or issues with breathing may want to find shelter or a different location to stay if they are bothered by smoke while inside their homes in the immediate area. He said the county's emergency management assisted with the air quality testing and remained on the scene. He said dust particles on the ground will be tested if need be. And Alyssa Robinson and Christina Hall report for the Detroit Free Press. Emily DeLetter and Sibel Mays Osterman report for USA Today. Irene?
Okay, continuing on this page, Texas wildfire caused by downed power pole, resident alleges in suit by Christopher Cann of USA Today. The largest wildfire in Texas history, which has killed two people and thousands of cattle across the state's panhandle, was the result of a downed utility pole, a lawsuit filed by a homeowner says. A cluster of fires broke out last week and quickly spread over several rural counties into neighboring Oklahoma, fueled by strong wind gusts and unseasonably dry conditions. As of Tuesday morning, the largest of the blazes, the Smokehouse Creek Fire, had ripped through more than 1 million acres, destroying hundreds of buildings, evacuating entire towns, and burning an area larger than the state of Rhode Island. On Friday, Melanie McQuitty, a homeowner in Stinnett, a city where many houses have been destroyed, filed a lawsuit against Xcel Energy Services and two other utilities. The lawsuit says the record-setting fire started when a wooden pole defendants failed to properly inspect, maintain, replace, splintered, and snapped off at its base. On February 28th, 2 days after the fires broke out, a law firm sent a letter to Xcel notifying the company of potential exposure for damages and requesting that a fallen utility pole near the fire's potential area of origin be preserved, according to a filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Kevin Cross, a spokesperson for Xcel, said that the fires are being investigated and that the cause has not been determined. He added that the company restored power in coordination with first responders and local officials. Our thoughts are with the families and communities impacted by the devastating wildfires across the Texas Panhandle, Cross said. As members of this community, we will continue to support our neighbors in this recovery. Aaron O'Connor, a spokesperson for the Texas A&M Forest Service, said that investigators were working with local law enforcement and that the cause is under investigation. McQuitty's lawyers did not immediately return USA Today's request for comment on early Tuesday. Fight to contain, put out the fires continues. Authorities expressed optimism in the days-long fight to quell the flames, and favorable weather conditions were forecast in the coming days. Overall, burn conditions are markedly improved from yesterday's weather, and the ability to fight fire on the ground is greatly enhanced, an update from the Texas A&M Forest Service said Monday. Hundreds of local, state, and federal personnel, as well as U.S. Army troops, have been fighting the fires. Dozens of bulldozers have dug out fire lines, and aircraft have dumped thousands of gallons of water and flame retardant on the blazes. As of Tuesday morning, 15% of the Smokehouse Creek fire had been contained, stretching across several counties. South of the Smokehouse Creek fire, north of Amarillo, the Windy Deuce fire burned 144,206 acres and was 55% contained as of Tuesday morning. To the east, the Grapevine Creek fire engulfed 34,882 acres and was 60% contained. The deaths of two women have been linked to the fire. Cindy Ohm was overtaken by flames on February 27th when she got out of her truck in Canadian, a city in Hemphill County, where dozens of structures were destroyed, according to the Texas Department of Public Safety. She was taken to a hospital where she died on Tuesday. The other victim, an 83-year-old woman, was identified by family members as Joyce Blankenship, a former substitute teacher. Her grandson, Lee Quisada, said deputies told his uncle Wednesday that they had found Blankenship's remains in her burned home. Contributing to this article, the Associated Press. Lori?
Justices paused Texas law that lets police arrest migrants, by Maureen Grappi and Lauren Villagran of USA Today. Washington. The Supreme Court has weighed in on the latest dispute between the Biden administration and Texas over the southern border, keeping a controversial state law from taking effect for now, while the law is being challenged. Swiftly responding to an emergency appeal from the Justice Department filed Monday afternoon, the court said it would keep on hold until at least March 13th a Texas law that empowers state law enforcement to detain and deport migrants entering or living in the U.S. illegally. A panel of judges on the New Orleans-based U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit had said the law would take effect Saturday unless the Supreme Court intervened. That would create chaos in the federal government's efforts to administer federal immigration law in Texas, the Justice Department said in its emergency appeal to the High Court. The department called the law flatly inconsistent with the court's past decisions, which recognize that the power to admit and remove non-citizens lies solely with the federal government. The emergency appeal is the latest development in the federal government's attempt to quash the law and is a part of a larger battle between Texas and the Biden administration over enforcement of the southern border. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, whose border crackdown also includes a program to bus migrants out of state and install razor wire barriers in the Rio Grande, argues the federal government isn't doing its job amid record crossings at the southern border. U.S. District Judge David Allen Ezra on Thursday preliminarily prevented Texas from enforcing the law, which would make it a state crime to cross the Texas-Mexico border. In his order granting an injunction, Ezra said that states may not exercise immigration enforcement power except as authorized by the federal government. Surges in immigration do not constitute an invasion within the meaning of the Constitution, nor is Texas engaging in war by enforcing SB 4, Ezra said. But the appeals court on Saturday granted Texas' request to intervene, giving the Biden administration a week to get the Supreme Court to decide whether the law should take effect while it's being challenged. The Supreme Court extended that deadline Monday and gave Texas until March 11th to tell the justices why the law should not remain on hold. The law is being challenged by El Paso County, Texas, and Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center. Abbott and the legislative authors of the bill say state troopers won't target longtime residents of Texas, but only those suspected of crossing illegally within the border zone. Border community leaders and immigrant advocates say the law will unfairly target their majority Hispanic communities. Large Texas border cities, including El Paso and Laredo, and small communities such as Roma and Eagle Pass, live by the coming and going of the U.S. and Mexico residents who crisscross the border lawfully to visit family, go to school, or do business. Allowing Texas to deport migrants to Mexico, the Justice Department told the Supreme Court would have significant and immediate adverse effects on the United States' relationship with Mexico, a relationship that is critical to the federal government's ability to effectively address immigration at the southwest border. Marisa Limon Garza, executive director of Las Americas, said she is worried SB 4 will lead to racial profiling, especially in border communities. When we cross here in El Paso with a passport or a visa, I don't get a stamp in my passport book, she said. How will state troopers know I crossed legally if there is no proof? The state says police officers are well trained and they will be able to make a determination based on behavior. If you are anything other than white or passing, then you can receive the strong hand of the law. Irene?
Okay, moving on to page 3. First OTC birth control pill available soon. Advocates say improving access is still a goal, by Nicole Fallert of USA Today. More than 50 years after the oral contraceptive pill went on the market in the United States, the country's first over-the-counter birth control pill will be available in stores and online nationwide this month. Known as O-Pill, that's capital O-P-I-L-L, the birth control pill will be available without prescription in major retailers and pharmacies in late March, the drug's maker, Perrigo, announced Monday. People have a new choice, a new option to access the oral contraceptive pill without a prescription, said Dana Singeiser, co-founder of Contraceptive Access Initiative, a nonprofit advocacy group. The medication will cost $19.99 for a one-month supply and $49.99 for a three-month supply in stores. Online customers can buy O-Pill at opill.com for $49.99 for a three-month supply and $89.99 for a six-month supply. Patients may begin pre-ordering the drug from select stores as of this week. A lot of consumer research went into our setting the retail price, said Sarah Young, chief commercial officer at Perrigo. O-Pill, which is 98% effective at preventing pregnancy, was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in July 2023 and will be the first of its kind available to Americans over the counter. For the first time in history, there is no permission required to access to birth control pills, Young said. It's truly a groundbreaking reproductive health product that will address key unmet need for contraceptive access. Now that details about access of O-Pill have emerged, reproductive health advocates say stocking the pill on retailer shelves and online is a step in the right direction, but more still needs to be done to ensure equitable access to quality reproductive health care nationwide. But reproductive rights advocates have to say about O-Pill. Reproductive rights advocates describe the arrival of O-Pill to American consumers as a major victory, but underscore the obligation to address other barriers to access, from cost to geographic availability. A first priority should be improving over-the-counter availability for other forms of birth control pill. And then in parentheses, O-Pill is progestin only, others containing estrogen and progestin await FDA approval. Perrigo confirmed that O-Pill can be paid or reimbursed through flexible spending or health savings accounts, also known as FSAs, HSAs, although parameters of these specific savings plans typically depend on employers' unique coverage offerings. The company confirmed a cost assistance program will be announced soon to help qualified low-income uninsured people get O-Pill. The company promised to let applicants know quickly if they qualify for the cost assistance program. Nearly $20 might be difficult for college students to pay monthly, said Divya Hutron, 20, a sophomore at the University of Alabama. She recently got on the pill and doesn't have insurance, but she pays about $18 for a three-month supply, nearly the cost of one O-Pill pack using pharmacy coupons. I think it takes a certain kind of budgeting and decision-making process. I don't believe students are thinking about Hortron said. You have to have that money readily available to make that purchase. Singusser raised questions about how people will access Opill in areas where major retailers have few or no stores. Opill will use major pharmacy chains to distribute their products, she said. I hope they look at other kinds of markets that are common throughout the country, particularly in rural areas. Telemedicine could be an option. Once Opill's cost and availability is better understood, NERCS, a telemedicine healthcare provider, plans to stock the medication, according to NERCS Chief Business Officer Carolyn Hoffman. The online provider serves more than 500,000 women across the United States, and more than 40% of those patients live in the South. Current birth control pill offerings can cost as little as $15 on NERCS, less than Opill's in-store online price, and NERCS offers automatic refills. As of now, a prescription is necessary to get birth control pills from NERCS. So the arrival of Opill to virtual retailers would basically transform the process into a one-stop shop for people, Hoffman said. That is one more option in our arsenal we can equip women with, Hoffman said. This would truly make it a one-touch type of experience. Deciding whether it's right for you. Though NERCS has yet to launch Opill on its platform, Hoffman said a majority of women may still opt for an appointment with a medical provider for reasons of cost and trust. Our hypothesis is that for the vast amount of women, it will still be cheaper to access contraceptives using their insurance versus buying Opill over the counter, Hoffman said, adding that many insurers don't have co-pays for a visit or for generic birth control pills already. It will still be, from an affordability standpoint, likely to be cheaper for a lot of patients to get a prescription. Just because the pill is available without a prescription doesn't mean people stop seeing their provider, said Dr. Reagan McDonald Mosley, CEO of Power to Decide, CAI Chief Medical Advisor, and a practicing OBGYN. But making Opill available without a prescription removes the barriers for people who know they want to use this method specifically, McDonald Mosley said. They don't have to jump through hoops to see a provider or take time off from work or navigate child care. But it doesn't preclude them from coming to see me or another provider if they have additional questions or want a different method. She added it's important to contextualize the Opill with how people experience birth control. Depending on their life stage, they may start with a pill early before moving to a more long-term solution like an implant, she said. Opill.com offers educational materials about the drug's safety and health in English and Spanish, Young said. Education is key for young people looking to use contraception for the first time, Hutron said, adding that for college students like her, leaving home can mean an immense burden to navigate healthcare decisions independently for the first time without familiar support systems. Misinformation causes people in my age range who are very impressionable and who may not have strong awareness of their bodies to avoid birth control just because they hear people whispering in their ear, she said. To decide whether Opill is the right choice, McDonald Mosley said it's best to consider the following. Pre-existing health conditions. If you're already pregnant, have breast cancer, or have undiagnosed irregular bleeding, McDonald Mosley suggests not taking the progestin-only pill and consulting your medical provider. Do you prefer to have a regular period? Patients on progestin-only pills like Opill take a pill daily for 4 weeks in a row without the skip or placebo week people may be used to having with combined pills, she said. This means users might experience some random bleeding or spotting. If you prefer having regular cycles of bleeding, McDonald Mosley said, the progestin-only pill might not be the preferred option. Are you a consistent person? The progestin pill must be taken within a 3-hour window daily, McDonald Mosley said, or else it can be ineffective. If you're someone who can reliably take the pill at the same time every day, it's probably a good fit for you. If you can't fit that regimen, combination pill might be the better option, she said. The election in the backdrop. The availability of the drug comes as the Biden administration attempts to rally around reproductive rights in the 2024 campaign season, a move galvanized by the fall of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court decision that had established the right to an abortion. As 14 states have moved to outright ban abortion and other states weigh restrictions, birth control has become an urgent topic for many people looking to avoid unwanted pregnancy. Hoffman said she has yet to see either political party attack plain vanilla contraceptive care to the extent other reproductive rights, including abortion and emergency contraception, have been conservative targets. Just over-the-counter birth control is not the only solution, she said. I think we really need to take a step back and think about how do you provide high-quality care everywhere in the country? How do you make it affordable? This is a great step, but it shouldn't be the only step. And contributing to this, Adriana Rodriguez. Lori?
Haiti descends into chaos and violence. Gang assaults aim to topple government, by Kim Helmgard, USA Today. A mass escape from two large prisons, gunfire exchanged at the central bank, main airport, and national soccer stadium, a direct challenge from a powerful gang leader to an unpopular prime minister. Haiti's long descending spiral of violence appeared to hit new lows in recent days as the country's powerful gangs led a series of coordinated assaults in what seemed to be an effort to overthrow the authorities. We have chosen to take our destiny in our own hands. The battle we are waging will not only topple Ariel's government, it's a battle that will change the whole system, said Jimmy Barbecue Cherizier, a former police officer who controls a confederacy of nine Haitian gangs known as the G9 Family and Allies, in a statement attributed to reports in local media. Ariel Henry is Haiti's U.S.-backed prime minister. Here's what's been happening in Haiti. Armed gangs stormed two large prisons. A 72-hour state of emergency began Sunday night after armed gangs stormed two large prisons, one in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, the other in Croix-des-Bouquets, on the city's outskirts. At least 12 people were killed and about 4,000 inmates, some accused of murders, kidnappings, and other serious crimes, escaped in the jailbreak. Haiti's Office of Citizen Protection said late Monday that it was seriously concerned about the safety of judges, prosecutors, victims, attorneys, and others following the mass escape. On Monday, gangs then tried to seize control of Haiti's main international airport. Reports from the scene said airport employees and others fled the scene amid whizzing bullets. This capped several weeks in which gangs exchanged fire with police and soldiers at or near state institutions, set police stations on fire, and forced businesses to close and kept people inside. The Secretary General is deeply concerned by the rapidly deteriorating security situation at Port-au-Prince, where armed gangs have intensified their attacks on critical infrastructure, said UN spokesman Stephane Dujarric, referring to Antonio Guterres, the head of the international body. It was not immediately clear Tuesday who controlled Haiti's international airport. And with that, we've come to the end of the hour. This is Lori Richards.
And Irene Friedman.
And we've been bringing you world and national news from USA Today. And we wish you a good night.
Good night, everyone.